It's a great mystery. The longer I'm on the spiritual path and the more people I get to know, the more I experience the incredible confusion that is my own nature and see it reflected back to me and the extraordinary variety that is everyone else's nature, as to why we do exactly what we do and how this process of spiritual development really takes place. Why is it that certain souls are drawn to certain paths and this reality is so clear? You know, some of us, I know my experience from childhood is very similar to many of yours. There was no point at which I had to be taught that life had some deeper purpose. Somehow I was born knowing that, even though nothing in my upbringing actually supported it. I don't mean to say that my family was superficial, because they were not, but they were intellectual, not spiritual. And their thoughts of what depth was about thinking and about ideas and about politics and to a certain extent about culture, but simply never about religion. The meaning of life was honorable living, justice, consideration for others, honesty, very good values. I feel extremely fortunate in the solidity of the moral training I received toward the end of my father's life, my parents' life. I began to write them occasionally, just basically letters of gratitude. It was a deliberate effort on my part also to influence them to their spiritual benefit to the extent that they were receptive to it, which was not explicit at all. But the simple fact that Master emphasizes very strongly that at the end of a person's life, it's extremely important to depart from this world with a positive attitude, because the consciousness with which we leave this world to a very large extent determines the consciousness we will have when we re-enter it. And all of us know what an agony of spirit it is to feel unworthy or to feel like a failure or to feel like all one's efforts end in nothing. There's a story that Swami tells when he went to visit a man on his deathbed in the hospital who was a devotee of Master, but somewhat distant, not a close disciple. And the man was, in his last days, was lamenting, "Oh, I've done so many wrong things in my life." And his whole consciousness was focused on sadness and regret. And when Swamiji reported this to Master, Master said, "Oh, that's so unfortunate. He's also done many good things in his life, and far better for him spiritually at this point to just let the bad go and focus on the good and let himself be defined by his positive reality." Danyon Brinkley, who does a great deal of hospice work and had, what do they call, near-death experiences, death experiences that turn out not to be permanent. So he dies and then he comes back, but he goes through the whole process of dying, and he talked about the life review. Saved by the Light is his book, and it's absolutely fascinating. And at the time that he was struck by lightning, because he's a very dramatic character and he doesn't do anything in halfway measures, so his death came because he was struck by lightning. He was an assassin for the CIA. And he would travel to foreign countries, and he was in Vietnam War, and he just would shoot people with a long-distance rifle. And he was a patriot and a bully, as he says himself, and this work suited him well. Except when he had his life review, what happens among many things in the life review, apparently, is that you get to experience in a zone that's out of time and space the effect of all your actions. So he got to experience the effect on all the people who were affected by all those individuals that he'd killed. And it was not a pleasant experience. I mean, many of the people that he assassinated were not very good people, but his own energy in doing that work was tainted. It wasn't an entirely noble act on his part. It was also the pleasure of a bully in taking the lives of others. And so that influenced the way that experience went for him. Well, as you can see, it's a very interesting book. He says now that he's completely turned his life around, that he really looks forward to his next life review because he knows it's going to be really a pleasure because of all the good work that he's done since that time. But in his hospice work, he has this thought that before people die, he said, let them get started. Let them get started on that life review process, and as much as possible before they leave this body, you know, make right the harms that they've done, or at least come to peace with them so that they won't have to carry all that unresolved karma into the next and the next and the next. So partly in this thought with my parents, I wanted them to start thinking as much as possible in terms of what they'd done right. So I wrote them letters, and especially when my father developed Alzheimer's, I would just send him little postcards because you couldn't really communicate to him in any long way or talk on the phone, completely confused him. And so I just sent him little postcards just with cheery comments about experiences that we'd had together. And it was a lovely thing. And then what was wonderful is that he would forget he would receive them, so the attendants where he was living could just give him the same old postcards and he could enjoy them all anew one more time, you know, like they had just arrived for the first time. And all of this puts us into a positive orientation. But having said all of this, it's just so remarkable to me how we're motivated and how we simply cannot understand what we can't understand. And it's so obvious to us when we finally see it, and we're so blind to it all that time before. You know, some of it is upbringing, some of it is karma. Who can say, because I started in on my family, my brother, who is a brilliant man, we lived in Texas, and he and his debate partner were the state champions in debate 2 years in a row, and you know they did respectively in the national championship. But it was partly because my entire life orientation was always toward debate. I never understood the art of conversation. I didn't understand that debate and conversation were two different things. I was much, much older than I would be proud to admit before I actually understood that conversation and debate were different. I thought that you always simply presented your best arguments first with all of your supporting data, and then you waited for the next person to do the same. And I couldn't understand why that was so often a conversation stopper. It seemed to me like the way you open it, you know, you have your 2 minutes and you just open your story. But then other people would sit silently and just stare at you. But you see, it's so obvious to everyone else, isn't it? How many times has someone just done some just unspeakable faux pas, utterly innocently? One woman friend of mine, she was so dear, her husband was just raised in a completely different context than her. And he did so many things that she considered so embarrassing. Except gradually, over years, she discovered that he wasn't the slightest bit embarrassed. To him, it was just a natural way to be. And for the peace of her own soul and of her marriage, she finally decided, why should I be embarrassed? What's inherently embarrassing about it? It's just simply not my way. And on the spiritual path, many of us, we just understand certain realities and we're so driven by those realities. To my mind, the fact which is referred to in our reading today of the threefold suffering, the inevitability, as the Gita puts it, of the suffering of old age, disease, and death, and the fleeting quality of our frail mortality. And in my life from a very young age, that fact has just loomed with so much intensity that everything that we try to commit to before I found the spiritual path, it just, the futility of it, given the eventual demise, always seems so self-evident. And yet there's so many people in the world to whom you say that, and they'll draw exactly the opposite conclusion, won't they? Well, then we better make hay while the sun shines, don't you think so? I mean, after all, life is fleeting. Let us grab and enjoy what we can. Same facts, but consciousness and life experience just make it completely differently. And so there's this whole teaching on the path of that self-will, that just following what we feel to do because we feel to do it, without necessarily referencing it to anything bigger than the little self, is just a perfectly fine way to live. Great books are written about this, and commitments are given, and it's considered healthy to go this way, to demand your what's yours and then just take it. And what is wisdom if not to keep what is mine for myself? We declare that development in our own festival of light. But then the Gita tells us just the opposite, that everything has to be weighed against this very morbid consideration of death, that all of youth has to be seen in the light of old age, and it would just be so easy to dismiss if it doesn't make any sense to you. And then there's the teaching that we have today, which is surrender to the greater divine will. And it's such a subtle point to understand, because we have to look not just to our intellectual ideas about this, but we have to look to the example of saints. This is one of the fundamental principles of self-realization as the definition of spiritual truth. And it goes in a very simple line like this. If it's possible to evolve, for one's consciousness to gradually expand until one reaches the state of complete self-realization, that means that in any incarnation, you know, an individual will be at a certain stage of development and others will be more advanced and also less advanced, but that progress is possible and that we can look toward those who have progressed more than we have to explain to us and to demonstrate to us what that spirituality really is like. And one of the great what really causes the demise of some of the more popular religions these days, like Christianity and Judaism, as two examples, is that the Catholic Church has maintained the concept of saints, but it no longer uses them in exactly the way they ought to be used, as actual practical examples of how we're supposed to live, because the methodology to become a saint is not clearly understood anymore. Saints just sort of happen. Usually they're persecuted and misunderstood, and then they're revered. But they're not seen as the footsteps in which we walk in the practical way that saints are revered in the tradition of yoga. In the tradition of yoga, what you see is someone who has mastered the art that we are trying to learn. And their example and their teaching is what tells us this is how it's meant to be done. And so we look to, we have in our tradition all of the masters whose pictures are on the altar. We also have the example of Swami Kriyananda, whose dynamic involvement in the world, whose extraordinary personal creativity, and masters also. Master was no isolated saint. He was a singer, he was a musician, he wrote music, he was an artist, he wrote books, he wrote poetry. He created institutions, he made little inventions, he looked for ways to earn money. He was just always doing many, many things in this world. And yet at the same time, we have this teaching, surrender the little will to the greater will of God. And so certainly we're not talking about a kind of passivity. We're not talking about a surrender that just gives us the license to just lean back in our chair and put our feet up and just wait to be delivered, or that allows us to just passively say, well, now I'm saved. You know, the example we have is really hard work, and the example of building Ananda, it's really hard work. It's not something that we can just sort of sit back and wait for others to do. That's the great advantage also of being so close to the origin point of a religious tradition. People come into Ananda and they think of it as all established, but many of you helped establish it and are helping to establish it even moment by moment. It's a work in progress. It's anything but finished. And whether it even continues or not, or just dies a kind of sputtering death, is entirely dependent on the commitment that all of you have. There's no Sunday service if you don't show up, you know? And there's no continuing property if we don't pay the mortgage. There's no expansion of our school if we don't finish our building. There's no new creative enterprises if we don't come up with them. And yet we have to do all this in a way that frees us from this limiting sense of identity instead of by our very actions hardening that reality, so that by the time that inevitable mortality sets in and we're snatched out of this body, do we joyfully step from this world into the next in a seamless flow of a state of consciousness that we have long enjoyed? Or are we ripped out of our bodies, you know, screaming and crying and desperately anxious not to give up all the things that we call ourselves? You know, in this country, often when people die, I was visiting a convalescent, well, whatever it's called now, retirement community. And, you know, so many people surround themselves, even in the last days of their life, with all the mementos of the life that they lived. And on one hand, you think, isn't it wonderful, you know, to celebrate everything that's been accomplished, and people who've had children, and the children have had children, and the children's children, children have had children, and you have these huge, beautiful tribes that all come back to this one origin point. On one hand, you know, that's a wonderful sort of giving forth of what the abundance of wisdom and love and understanding that we have. That's a marvelous thing to do. But if we've done it as ourselves, look what I've accomplished, and then all that accomplishment begins to fade away, then we have this terrible sense of diminution of self. Whereas if we've understood, and it's sort of hard to find just exactly the right images, but it's a little bit like if you're living in the army, or you're in a group, and the power that you have, or singing in a choir. When a beautiful choir gets up and sings, and our Christmas oratorio will have 60 or 70 voices, you know, all of those voices together just make this extraordinary flow of sound that is angelic in nature. When you're standing in the choir and it's your voice is one of them, or you're sitting in the audience and the sound is sweeping over you, it's just so much bigger than any one person can do. And each person in the choir, whatever little note they're adding to it, if everyone else went silent and just your little voice was out there, would be such a different experience. But working in that harmony, rehearsing together, learning your own part perfectly, but nonetheless singing it in concert, makes a very different reality. And so we live in this world, in this apparent individuality, with all of our creativity and our own ideas of what we're going to do. But our reality is in fact so interwoven, not just in a horizontal way, not just person to person. This is a limitation that people run into when they try to make their religion just the love we have for one another. Because there's this inherent, I don't want to be really too sad about this, but there's inherent sense of tragedy in that. You know, because it's so ephemeral. You know, little children who are so adorable grow up, and sometimes they're not so cute when they grow up, or they break their parents' hearts in one way or another. Or the parents depend on the family, and then the family in one way or another. Or people are just not good. They have their own little tragedies that they have to act out. But when we understand that chorus, and the word I can only think of is it's a vertical chorus. It's a chorus of God and the masters singing and setting the tone for us. Just like in our choirs, in every section, there's a few people who really know the music and have it so much in their being that you can always sort of lean into their sound, and their sound will define it for everyone. They'll keep the note true, and they'll keep the section true. So it is that we live, and there are above us, there are angelic beings. The whole story is of angels and masters and devas and light beings showering down upon this world. It's all of it's true. There's a tremendous force of loving kindness acting through beings with material bodies or light bodies or causal bodies that are responding to the sincere desire of so many souls to know what's really true. And all of us are among that. The the longing of our heart, a prayer of love went up from earth, and God responded. And God responds at all times, not necessarily with great flashes of light, you know, that we see in letters of gold written in front of us. It's much more subtle than that. It's a constant influence. What note are we going to sing next? Are we listening to the leader of our section who has the tone just perfectly? Or are we sort of lost in our kind of subconscious miasma and we wander off? I'm sure all of you have had the experience, which I will confess to openly, of sitting there meditating, being in the temple, even in a group meditation, and the posture's right and everything is in place, and all of a sudden you realize you are somewhere else and it is not super conscious. You know, you're just off. Just out somewhere singing some song of your own creation. You know, maybe you're just planning your work day or making your grocery list or rehashing some argument or whatever it might be. And it's just like you're gone. You know, the personal will has just taken over. There's no cooperation. There's no listening for what the real note ought to be. And in our spiritual lives, of course, many of you I know are disciples. It's a profound and total commitment that we've made that we're going to work in harmony. We're going to literally give over the responsibility for the direction of our life to one whom we have become convinced in our heart of hearts understands far better than we do where our happiness lies. But merely to make that statement is in itself is just a promise. It has to be acted upon. It has to be acted upon day after day after day with a constant listening. And the surrender that we speak of, another way of putting it is to respond, to listen, to have the desire to be open, to be guided. And it's very important that we not become anxious about it. So many things on this spiritual path, it takes a great deal of humility and self-confidence combined to follow a spiritual path, the spiritual path of self-realization. Because we have to have the humility just to recognize that we need help. I mean, really, we need help. There was a little story from the Winnie the Pooh series that I always particularly liked. Piglet is a character that I used to identify with, partly because I used to wear striped shirts a lot, and so did Piglet. But Piglet is very sincere and very enthusiastic, but often he didn't quite have the strength to carry on. And the steadfastness of Winnie the Pooh and Christopher Robin had to help him through. And there's this one story in which Winnie the Pooh, the teddy bear, and Piglet go off walking, and they get very, very lost because this deep fog sets in. Of course, Christopher Robin finds them, and it turns out they're not really very far away. But in the middle of the whole thing, they're just, they don't know where they are. And Winnie the Pooh decides it's a good time maybe to take a nap or to open a can of honey. He has some very pragmatic sort of way. But Piglet could think of nothing to do except to put his head down in despair and then periodically lift it up to say, "Help, help!" like that. Somehow that picture has always touched my heart. Many, many times in our spiritual life, really, it comes to that, doesn't it? You know, the courage is gone. All the pots of honey have been eaten. We've slept as much as we can sleep. And the only thing left is just to put our heads down, but lift it up every once in a while and just cry out, "Help, help. I've lost the note. I've lost the melody. I don't even know what song we're singing anymore. You know, where is it?" And it's not, again, as I was saying, that it necessarily has these great big experiences. Our faith is built not on those dramatic moments, really, but on the little by little steady transformation of consciousness that comes more like a whisper, as Master called his book, Whispers from Eternity. Just this sudden sort of little bubble of possibility comes to mind and some little idea. Where do those little ideas come from? Those little ideas are planted in our consciousness from a higher realm when we sincerely ask Divine Mother, when we ask Master, when we ask our guardian angels, please don't abandon me. Don't leave me to my own devices. All these incarnations when I've just lived according to what I've thought was right, without any understanding of where I was going, I'm done with that, Lord. Even if I'm the least of your children, even when all is said and done, I'm the runt of the litter and I never grow, I'm still part of your family. And naughty or good, you're just going to have to guide me. This is what I was saying about the humility and the willingness simply just to understand, what choice do we have? You know, are we only going to follow this path if we're perfect in it? Are we only going to follow this path if we're the recognized one who always gets it right? We are Divine Mother's own. We have given our lives to these high ideals. And naughty or good, successful and noble and impressive, or the very least among them. Even if we're at the end of the line, you know, still with our little blankie and our thumbs in our mouth, just trailing along. There was a time in our community when we had 9 little boys in the community, and they went from about 10 years old down to the youngest, who was maybe 3 or 4 at that time. And there was a bit of a gap between the next to the smallest and the smallest. And often I would look out the window of my community, and they would be running according to size, because they would be following the leader, and they could all run at a speed exactly consistent with how big they were. So the oldest one would be streaking across in the whole parade, and then there would always be this little gap, and then here would be the little guy, you know, just desperately trying to make it. But he never gave up. He just was always pumping like that. And I thought, boy, Lord, isn't that what it's like? But he never quit, because he had given himself to growing up. He had given himself to following this lead. And so it is with us. Swami has told us so many times, Master doesn't mind our failings. Master doesn't mind our mistakes. The only thing that concerns him is our indifference. Because if we're indifferent, then we just go back to, you know, we just sail off singing our own little song. Everybody else is singing Bluebell, and we're singing Come Gather Round. You know, we're just singing our own little words over here, just chanting along, and we don't even know that the chorus is there. You know, until the day of reckoning comes, and we look around and wake up again in another body. You know, even if you sing badly, listen for the notes, do your best, be the little one running along. I find it comforting sometimes just to say, all right, you know, when it's all over, Master, the only thing I'll be able to say is, well, I tried, you know. But if we do say that, if we can say that, Master made the promise, the extraordinary promise, for those who persevere to the end, he said, when the day of death comes, I or one of the other masters will be there to take you across into the next world. He didn't say, for those who are outstandingly, thrillingly successful in their efforts on the spiritual path. He said, if you don't quit, that's all. Because you see, even that takes everything we have. But give it all you've got, because what choice do we have? You know, as Swami said, we have to live anyway. We might as well live in the right way. Bless you.